Kickstart your day at 7 and get the news you need from the perspective you want. News One Now with Roland Martin, every weekday morning at 7 on TV One.
Good morning, I'm Roland Martin, and just ahead on News One Now on this MLK Day, the three Democratic contenders for the White House face off before the voting starts in Iowa just 2 weeks from today. We'll break down the Democratic debate. Also, we focus on the life and legacy of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. We'll chat with his daughter, Dr. Bernice King. Also, we'll talk with author Eddie Glaude about this whole issue of America's infatuation or refusal to still deal with race in America. Plus, we'll also show you talk about Tavis Smiley's book, Last Year of Dr. King's Life, and Sweet Honey in the Rock. They, of course, are well known for their freedom songs. We'll also give you a taste of their beautiful voices. It's time to bring the funk on News One Now on TV One. First off, we want to wish all of you a happy MLK Day. Of course, this is the national holiday of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday. And so we'll start the show off with a Democratic debate last night where Dr. King was often referenced in the discussions of the various candidates, including Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, of course, Senator Bernie Sanders, and Governor Martin O'Malley. Of course, it took place in South Carolina, so there in Charleston, just frankly, a few yards from where the Charleston massacre took place at Emmanuel AME. Many of the topics raised last night were tailored to African Americans. It took place on NBC. Lester Holt was one of the moderators, of course, the first African American to moderate a debate this season. Gun control, police brutality, also the issue of crime. All of those issues came up in the debate. Here's a taste of what the Democrats talked about.
90 people a day die from gun violence in our country. That's 33,000 people a year. One of the most horrific examples, not a block from here, where we had 9 people murdered.
We have seen in this city a horrendous tragedy of a crazed person praying with people and coming out and shooting 9 people. This should not be a political issue.
Well, sadly, it's reality. And it has been heartbreaking and incredibly outraging to see the constant stories of young men like Walter Scott, as you said, who have been killed by police officers. There needs to be a concerted effort to address the systemic racism in our criminal justice system.
We have a criminal justice system which is broken. Who in America is satisfied that we have more people in jail than any other country on earth, including China, disproportionately African American and Latino? Who is satisfied that 51% of African American young people are either unemployed or underemployed?
When I ran for mayor in 1999, Lester, it was not because our city was doing well. It was because we were burying over 300 young, poor black men every single year. And that's why I ran, because, yes, black lives matter. And we did a number of things. We weren't able to make our city immune from setbacks, as the Freddie Gray unrest and tragic death showed. But we were able to save a lot of lives.
This is a responsibility for the U.S. Justice Department to get involved. Whenever anybody in this country is killed while in police custody, this should automatically trigger a U.S. Attorney General's investigation.
Let's get right to it with our panel. Joining me right now is Eddie Glaude Jr. He, of course, is the chair of the African American Studies Department at Princeton University and also the author of the book, Democracy in Black. Dr. Avis Jones DeWeaver, leadership strategist, Exceptional Leadership Institute for Women. Ralph Chittum, senior vice chair of the D.C. Republican Party. Lawn Victoria Burke, managing editor of Politics365.com. Folks, one of the things that I found interesting when Lester Holt asked the question about the Walter Scott case, and then he also referenced what took place at Emmanuel AME, it was within the conversation of gun violence. The problem I had with the question was, later there was a question that was raised about domestic terrorism, but the Charleston shooting wasn't put in that category. Yeah. Secondly, the question dealt specifically with the shooting of black men, but the reality is, Ayanna Jones, yeah, killed in Detroit, Rekia Boyd killed there in Chicago. It's also impacting black women. And so I thought that was, overall we heard some questions we haven't heard beforehand, but I still felt that could have been just a bit more depth, if you will, in terms of what we heard.
Absolutely. I mean, you're right. The needs and the issues relating specifically to black women were totally just ignored in this particular debate. And also, as it relates to your point here, it's interesting to me that when that question was asked about Emmanuel, Bernie Sanders' reaction was, this is some crazed man. No, it wasn't some crazed man. That was a domestic terrorist who specifically targeted black people. That was a hate crime. And I'm just disturbed. I can expect Nikki Haley to sort of gloss over that, but I would expect that in the Democratic Party, at least there would be some frontal examination of the fact that this was a hate crime, and this is an example of the death that's associated with racism in America.
But who's surprised that it would be spun in that sort of a way? You know, our current president, you know, he's been criticized for not addressing black issues in a way that the black community wants them to be addressed. Well, if he's not going to do it, why should we expect three white people to do it? I mean, that's just logical. So that, you know, it may have been a debate put on by the Congressional Black Caucus, Leadership Foundation, or whatever it was.
Congressional Black Caucus Institute.
Institute, I'm sorry. But they were playing to a much bigger audience. And unfortunately, they know that they can take the votes from our community pretty much for granted, so they don't have to address the issues in the way that we want them addressed or in the way that they should be addressed.
I think the question around domestic terrorism is really important. I think the way it was gendered is really important, but I also think they narrowed the conversation. No one talked about Laquan McDonald. No one talked about Sandra Bland. Right. So the way in which we could actually engage, the way in which our communities are policed, mm-hmm. the way in which our communities are surveilled, they seem to move in a different direction from my vantage point.
Lauren?
Yeah. Obviously, there was a problem last night with subject matter. This is a debate that is supposed to be sponsored by the CBCI, and I get all that. But somewhere somebody decided that they weren't going to spend more than 20 minutes on issues that disproportionately impact black people. I mean, you're not talking about HBCUs. You're not talking about Chicago. Flint, Michigan only came up because Hillary brought up Flint, Michigan.
And the part where they said, hey, is there anything y'all want to bring up?
Michigan. So, I mean, it's weird because I think Lester Holt actually did a really good job. But somewhere I think probably the Democratic Party or somebody decided that they weren't going to have a discussion more than 20 minutes over African-American issues. And that is a problem. That is a huge problem when you're getting 90% of black votes.
But here's the other thing. I get the whole focus where you want to talk about ISIS and Iran, but
I don't.
No. I get it because foreign policy is a huge part of being a president. But when I look at debates, when I look at multiple debates, I believe you should have narrowly tailored debates.
Exactly right.
So you have domestic issues, and if you are CBCI. Is black
that's
stuff.
Right.
So
and,
I heard
Andrea
nothing.
Mitchell,
I heard nothing.
That's the
nothing
thing.
On education.
Andrea Mitchell could have asked them that at some interview on her show that she has every day. So that Syria, ISIS, Iran stuff didn't ever need to come up.
Well,
they
but
could
here's
always
the deal.
Domestic debate.
But if you want to bring up foreign policy, first of all, if you want to frame it that way with the CBCI, mm-hmm. but you could have frankly asked the question, okay, let's talk about those African countries where you're having to deal with terrorism.
Right.
Let's talk about whether or not what's happening in Nigeria, Boko Haram, that didn't come up. Right. What's happening in Sudan, what's happening in those nations. And so one of the other things that I think was, again, bothersome for me, I heard nothing about education.
Mm-hmm. Nothing.
Not a single
right.
question.
Not one
question. And I'm going, we talking about black folks. I was just in South Carolina Saturday speaking to the National Alliance of Black School Educators. I spoke there in Myrtle Beach. Mm-hmm. And I'm going, that's an issue for us,
absolutely
nothing.
But we do get a question on Bill Clinton's sex life, but we don't get a question on HBCUs. It's crazy. I mean, that to me, the Democrats who, you know, this is Debbie Wasserman Schultz or CBCI, somebody dropped the ball there.
There's one thing that I found to be interesting, that whole exchange between Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton when it came to Wall Street. I thought he was nailing her on that. Yeah. That to me also is what I think is resonating with a lot of young folks also. A lot of folks as well, because they were taken care of. Wall Street, Main Street, MLK Street still got screwed.
Yeah, I mean, I have never heard that kind of political rhetoric in a presidential campaign in all of my life, right? And I'm not that old, and I'm not that young, but I had never heard someone come at 600,000 from Goldman
right.
Sachs
repeatedly,
and then promise
600 grand a year,
and then promise that no one from Goldman Sachs would be, right, in his administration if he was elected. So, and then to talk about how Wall Street owns American
right.
politics,
right.
how we can't get anything done. That this isn't about a substantive disagreement.
Right.
Right. It's really about big money keeping us from actually
moving
forward.
But once again, I mean, that's Bernie's focus on this whole income inequality thing, but he did not racialize it anyway. Why not then also talk about, or why wasn't a question asked about really the implications of what happened on Wall Street on the Black community? We lost half of our wealth
right.
as a result of the housing crisis.
Well, and that's the other piece. Exactly. Nothing about a housing crisis.
Nothing about the economy specifically
homes,
as it relates to the Black community. Nothing about addressing the fact that many of us in South Carolina and other southern states are not getting the effects of the health care program because of the governors that are blocking the way. Why weren't any of these issues addressed?
And you're sitting in South Carolina where you have Congressman Jim Clyburn, who's offered his 10-20-30 amendment right. where 10% of federal funds go to those counties where 20% more of the people have lived in poverty, below the poverty line for 30 years.
Yep.
He's sitting right there. I don't know if they didn't know. Well, I'm assuming they didn't know about it. But again, to me, that's how you sort of moving forward, and I was just sort of just sitting there, and then the whole in the weeds about Bernie Sanders' healthcare deal. But here's a piece, Ralph and Lauren, before I go to break, people don't understand about that. The reason you had a high percentage of people who did not like the Affordable Care Act was because they were opposed. There was a significant number of Democrats who were opposed to not having single payer.
That's true.
So when Bernie Sanders is talking about single payer, he's actually playing to that significant population.
Right. Yeah.
So that doesn't mean they don't want health care.
Right.
They want a single payer.
Right. But also, let's get into the weeds of the numbers, because if you look at the numbers, unfortunately, the Black community has fallen behind economically in the past 8 years. So they
all tied to the recession, tied to the housing crisis, right. tied to Wall Street screwing America.
Right. So they couldn't get into it because, unfortunately, or fortunately, depending upon what side of the aisle you want to sit on, if you talk about the Black community losing ground in the past 8 years, that sort of falls in our president's lap. So they couldn't get into the weeds because then they would be viewed as attacking the president.
Yeah. Lauren, if there was one debate that should have been all about Black people,
exactly.
it was the one sponsored by the Congressional Black Caucus Institute. You cannot tell me right. if Maraza or if any Latino group, you can't tell me if they had a debate on Univision, you would not have all discussion about Latino.
Yeah, and the era of just happy to be here, just happy to have your issues come up has to end. And that's why that first part where we did get into some Black Lives Matters issue. I mean, that happened because Black Lives Matter, of course, has
right.
been ringing the bell. But the single payer thing is a loser for Hillary Clinton. Does anybody really believe that Bernie Sanders is against health? That's just a complete loser. And she keeps getting into the weeds on that, and it's a waste of everybody's time.
All I'm saying is, if you're going to be the CBC eyes, make it perfectly clear. Black discussion. The whole debate.
Right, 2 hours. Right.
Trust me, if it was on Univision, you wouldn't have had a whole lot of other stuff. I'm just saying, okay? But maybe also come to a Black network, and that might happen.
Hey.
Coming up, Bernice King and I talk about her father's legacy, whether he would support Black Lives Matter movement or not. Also, a value gap still causes Americans to value white skin over everything else. Eddie Locke Jr. talks about how we can focus on the issue of race in America with Democracy in Black. Plus, Tevin Smiley breaks down the last year of Dr. King's life. And what was one of his greatest speeches ever? We'll break that down, the mountaintop speech. Most of y'all haven't even paid attention to most of that speech. Just that last clip, one of the greatest speeches he ever gave. All of that next on News 1 Now, right here on this MLK Day on TV One.
I love Thurgood Marshall. I grew up with Roy Wilkins and Whitney Young. They wouldn't give us an inch. They tried to block the March on Washington. They criticized us for sitting in, and they were scared to death of mass marches and jail-ins. We took it, and we took responsibility for it, but then we recognized their leadership. We couldn't have done, Martin Luther King could not have done what he did in 1955.
Wherever you are, we are. Your centerpiece for Black thoughts in America. It's News One Now with your host, Roland Martin.
Bernice King is one of four children of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and Coretta Scott King. She's also the CEO of the King Center. She and I recently had a great conversation, and we talked about how America, including Black folks, limit her father's greatness to two speeches, the I Have a Dream speech and the Mountaintop speech. He was certainly more than that.
I have intentionally decided that every year during the commemorative service that we have to use one of my father's speeches.
Mm-hmm.
Because every year we were doing a litany, and while I honor that litany, I felt that people needed to see more sides to my father.
Right.
And so when we did the anniversaries, we were drawing upon, of course, we started with I Have a Dream. But we dealt with the speech he gave on the steps of the Alabama State Capitol last year. And this year, we're doing the speech he delivered at Soldiers Field in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
So every year, there will be a new speech so that people understand that Daddy was more broad and more depthful than just, I have a dream, and I've been to the mountaintop.
How do we also educate people and move them beyond even those speeches? Understand that what Dr. King was doing with SCLC, they were master strategists. And that's why I think the movie Selma was great, because you yes. got a sense when they were in that living room going, talking and trying to figure out the different moves and strategizing how to keep the movement going forward.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you 100%, because I think that's what's missing and lacking in the movement today. We're not thinking about strategy. I think people are more focused on, we're getting the attention of people, and that's good. Now what are you going to do with the attention? And so you do have to have a strategy. I think it's important that the generation that's now leading this movement, and I know this is hard because this is where the chasm is, that they connect with those that came before, not to tell them what to do, but to share with them how they did it, how they were able to successfully launch a campaign and bring about powerful legislation and even help to transform some hearts. They work strategy, and it has to be ongoing. It's not like you get together one time and that's it, because there are forces that will continue to come against you, and you got to keep strategizing. And we teach that in our Nonviolence 365 education and training. And so, you know, we're doing the part that we can do, but I just encourage people to please.
Mm-hmm.
We're losing that generation. I mean, rapidly.
You mentioned earlier in terms of the work that you're doing at the King Center. Give our viewers a sense of exactly what that is. For, I mean, first and foremost, they explain exactly what the mission of the King Center is and what that work you're doing right now.
Well, it's a process of learning, first and foremost, Dr. King's principles and steps of nonviolence. Those principles are very key because they provide the heart and soul of how you approach people. And I'll give you just a quick example. We teach that nonviolence does not seek to destroy individuals, but it seeks to attack the issue. And that's very hard for people because people are the ones causing the issue. But you have to figure out how to separate the personhood out of it and realize that person is still worthy of dignity and respect, but you can still identify what the issue is that they are addressing. In 2015, we brought together some of the activists here and mm-hmm. some of those in the movement, because we're fortunate to have a lot of people that were in my father's movement who live right here in the city of Atlanta. And it's a very interesting discussion because obviously people see things differently. But I think it was the beginning of something, because many of them have reached out, even though some of them still feel we're going to do it our way, and that's fine. But the reality is, at some point, they're going to realize that what the folk did before was very successful, and there's something that they can extract from it.
Speaking,
so we have dialogue and discussion with them.
Speaking about that, I mean, how do you respond to the critics of Black Lives Matter who say, see, if Dr. King was here, he wouldn't like these things that you do, that you're doing and you're saying, and he would be doing the total opposite of what these folks are doing?
Well, I think there needs to be some fine tuning. I think my father would commend them on their courage, on their willingness to stand up to these causes. But I also think my father would counsel with them not to tell them what to do, but more so to hear them. And from hearing them, just as he did with SNCC, he would probably still encourage them to embrace nonviolence because he believed it was the most potent weapon that we had, especially as minorities in this country, because we don't have a Navy, Marine, et cetera. You know, he would support them. I think he would support them, but slightly guide them and help them see what they did and how they did it, and allow them to see what it is they would want to extract from that.
But it's interesting because one of the things that I often tell people, anytime he did interviews on national television and they wanted him to condemn Malcolm X or to trash other leaders,
exactly,
he always was smart enough not to get caught, exactly, into that trap and to be himself, to still be positive and affirming, exactly, and not get into the, oh, there they are, they're at odds with one another.
Exactly. Exactly. He was brilliant at seeing the best and the good in every situation and extracting that. He was a master, I call it synthesis. So mm-hmm. he could synthesize everybody's position to try to bring about a common position. He was very brilliant at speaking to people's issues and concerns. Even when he engaged Stokely Carmichael, when they were continuing the march that Meredith started against fear.
Right.
And they had the whole dialogue about Black power. And he understood where Stokely was coming from. And he was saying, you know, but however, we don't want them to mix up the message and lose what we're really trying to do. Because while I may agree with you that we need more power, mm-hmm. What really we need to do is to make sure they understand what that is about. And so that's when he suggested, you know, some other semantics to Stokely, and of course Stokely still said Black power nonetheless. But my father, you know, he's a cool cat. I mean, a lot of people didn't know that. He's just a cool cat. He could take it.
How important is it for people to go back and read Chaos or Community? Where do we go from here? Because there are so many parallels between that written after the riots in 66 and 67, and then what is happening today.
Well, I mean, that's almost like a rhetorical question, Golden, because it is important to read it. It's the last book that he literally penned. And I think he captured the state of our nation and world at that particular time, which is interesting. You're talking about almost 50 years later, 49 years since he published it. And it changed a little bit of the language. It's now. And so the reason they should read it is because it's now. It speaks to every literal thing we are dealing with now. And I remember in 2013, Time Magazine put Daddy on the cover. And the caption was, and this is for the I Have a Dream edition they did, it was Founding Father, but that didn't intrigue me. What intrigued me was the subcaption, Architect of the 21st Century. Now, he was 32 years shy of living in the 21st century. And yet he was the architect, according to this individual. And so that book really is that blueprint that we need that can help us in terms of addressing everything that we're facing, not just in America, but all across the world.
Well, as we understand, King Day is not a day for folks to focus on picnics and shopping. It is certainly a day of action, day of commitment, and a day of service. Bernice, we appreciate it. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Roland. I appreciate it.
When we come back, we'll talk about how America continues to be enslaved by the issue of race. The author of a new book, Democracy in Black. We'll talk with Eddie Glaude. Also, Tabby Smiley has a book about the last year of Dr. King's life. We'll show you that as well. Plus, what was one of the greatest speeches King gave? The one he gave the night before he was killed. And Sweet Honey and the Rock will be right here sharing with us about their freedom songs. All of that on News One Now on TV One on this MLK Day.
I'm not quite sure why the Creator was so generous to have given us in our lifetime the crop of people that led so many struggles that changed the course of human history, touched by a certain kind of spiritual power and a certain kind of inner gift.
The first step is to join the movement.
Begin to mobilize and move people to action now.
Step number two, roll out.
The way I roll is when you've shown one time you can do it, no excuses after that.
We're your centerpiece for Black thoughts in America. It's News One Now with Roland Martin. Roland Martin.
Pick a Agent Smith calling for an Oscar boycott. Well, the actress has turned to social media to air her frustrations over the lack of blacks in this year's Academy Award nominations. The actress, her husband is Will Smith, of course, was left out of Oscar contention for his performance in Concussion. She said this in a Facebook post over the weekend, quote, "At the Oscars, people of color are always welcome to give out awards, even entertain, but we are rarely recognized for our artistic accomplishments. Should people of color refrain from participating altogether, people can only treat us in the way in which we allow, with much respect in the midst of deep disappointment." Jay. Other African-American stars took to social media to weigh in on Oscar So White. Film producer Will Packer spoke out via Twitter saying, quote, "To my Academy colleagues, we have to do better, period. The reason the rest of the world looks at us like we have no clue is because in 2016, it's a complete embarrassment to say that the height of cinematic achievement have only been reached by white people." Actor Don Cheadle wasn't short on the sarcasm in his tweet to Chris Rock saying, at Chris Rock, "Yo, Chris, come check me out at hashtag the Oscars this year. They've got me parking cars on G level." Of course, the Academy airs on February 28th. Last year, the ratings were down because many black folks tuned out. But you know what? It's all good because on February 5th, let's be clear, NAACP Image Awards will be taking place, airing right here on TV One. And so that's where, keep in mind, the Image Awards was created for the very reason, and that is the exclusion of African-Americans being represented. And so I would hope many of those A-listers who sometimes shun the Image Awards will show up for that broadcast as a show of support for those African-Americans who have been nominated for NAACP Image Awards. And so again, we'll have continuous coverage of Oscars So White and also the Image Award over the next 2 weeks. Sorry, folks. This whole issue with Oscar also ties into this whole issue of race in America. We still, whether we want to admit it or not, are still locked into this battle of dealing with our racial history. Earlier, we talked about the Democratic debate and the issues that were impacting us in terms of this depression. My next guest calls the Great Black Depression. And so he's Eddie Glaude Jr. The book is called, folks, Democracy in Black, How Race Still Enslaves the American Soul, laying out how much work there is to be done as we celebrate the work of Reverend Dr. King. And Eddie, one of the things that I think people have to remember, and but you're fine, you're okay. Fine. People have to remember, and that is Dr. King's last book, KSO Community, Where Do We Go From Here,
right,
was one, when it came out, his worst-selling book. Mm-hmm. Folks didn't want, to hear it, and he literally in that book predicted exactly where we are today by saying that even our liberal white friends are not going to be with us when it's time to write that check to fix the economic wrongs that have hurt African-Americans. We're still seeing it today.
Right. I actually opened up the book with a quote from Dr. Mm-hmm. King from 1967, right? And part of what he was suggesting was that America was schizophrenic. On the one hand, it says it's committed to the ideals of democracy, but on the other hand, it's committed to these practices that are fundamentally undemocratic. And so I make the claim in the book that at the heart of this thing, whether we talk about the achievement gap, the wealth gap, the empathy gap, all the gaps, but at the heart of it is the value gap. And the value gap is this. It's the basic belief that white people in this country matter more than others. And to the extent that is true, Roland, no matter what the inputs are, the outputs will still be the same. So the value gap obtained in the context of slavery, the value gap was present in the context of Jim Crow, and the value gap is present with a black man in the White House. So we got 38% of our children who are living in poverty. The first time in the history of us keeping that data, that black there are more poor black children than there are white children. And there are three times as many white children in this country. We look at 13 times white wealth, 13 times that of black wealth. We look at 240,000 homes lost. Even when we talk about the unemployment numbers, people are talking about, well, we're not at 16% or 15%, right? We're at 8-point-something percent. We know that's the holiday employment numbers that are skewing that figure. But 9.4, 9.8%, depending upon who you're talking to, right? At the height of the Great Recession, white folk were losing their mind over 9.8%. Right? 9.6%. So part of what we need to do is to figure out how to close this gap. And what we need is what Dr. King called for, and I call for it in the book, is a revolution of value. We need to change how we view government. We need to change how we view black people, which means we got to change how we view white people. And we need to change what ultimately matters to us.
And also, I think, well, and again, a lot of people, I've already seen some comments, they're like, well, you know, you're too critical of President Barack Obama. And we've heard this from other folks as well. That was the same thing when we had Tavis on here on Friday with his book, The Covenant, 10 Years Later. But one of the points that I have said from the moment he was elected, even before he was elected, that he is the first black president, but he is also the 44th president. You can't let the first override the 44th because you have to ask of him that what you asked of the previous 43 and what you're going to ask of the 45th.
Exactly.
That's right.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, and then we got caught up in this red herring. Is he black enough? Right. Is he going to embrace a black agenda? That wasn't the question. The question is, are you committed to justice? Are you committed to policies that will help the most vulnerable? We often forget that when John Edwards, the late John, the whatever John Edwards is doing now, but when John Edwards dropped out of the campaign, remember in New Orleans?
Mm-hmm.
President Obama, and he endorsed President Obama in New Orleans, and President Obama said, candidate Obama said at that moment, poverty will be my main issue, because remember that was the issue driving the, mm-hmm. the Edwards campaign. I mean, poverty over the last 8 years, right? Part of what we're trying to do, right? We have to become more politically mature, and we have to engage this not as being excited about having access because there's a black man in the White House. We have to really and substantively address the crisis that's engulfing our community. We have communities that have been simply devastated since 2008, and they haven't come back online.
Mm-hmm. I completely agree. And what I find very interesting about the conundrum that we found ourselves in is you're right. I think we've kind of been taken aback. This was a first, and we didn't really understand how to play both inside and outside politics at the same time. Mm-hmm. You know, with previous presidents, we've understand the power of outside politics, the power of agitation, the power of making demands externally. But once we got in, it was sort of this sort of protective nature, I believe, that we had around this president, not wanting to have those sort of outside critiques in a constructive way, married with the inside game as well. How could we have done a better job of pushing an agenda forward from maximizing on both of those fronts?
Well, I think we need to have a robust conception of what democracy means for our community, right? And part of that means expanding the nature of the black demos, right? What do I mean by that? We need to get those folks who are on the margins, those folk who seem to be voiceless, to be more engaged in the political process. We needed to have an agenda to get them to work. We needed an agenda, right, to have the housing initiative in response to the housing crisis to really speak to the racism that was at the heart of the housing bubble. We needed, in effect, right, single payer, but we didn't get it, mm-hmm. right? It would have been better for our community. Right. But in some ways, we needed advocates to move beyond, right, the glare and the excitement of having a black man in the White House.
We also needed advocates who were more concerned about those issues as opposed to having cabinet secretaries show up at your conferences.
Boom.
No, I'm just being straight
that's
up.
It. I mean,
it also had to be, and again, the black convention, it also goes beyond, even goes beyond the president, and that is the folks who were solely focused on the presidency, while in 2010, many folks, white, young, black, set out the midterms, and all of a sudden you begin to see voter suppression come in because Republicans, 16 legislatures flipped,
right.
Governor Manchin's flipped.
Right.
And so it was a whole different piece. And so I think part of the thing that the president is going to have to own up to is also the decimation of this political structure within DNC.
Yeah.
And you heard Bernie Sanders say last night, you need to have a 50-state strategy.
Yep.
So this goes beyond electing one person.
Once OFA was created, that was out the window because the president, of course, made it all about him. And in fact, that permeates through the policy. I mean, we need the advocacy, thank goodness, is getting younger and is changing, right. You know, to people who are bluntly stating what the problem is, and I think they're going to get to the point.
Who bluntly told him in the Oval Office?
Right, in the Oval Office.
Black Lives Matter.
Phil mm-hmm. Agnew and them were not amused by just being there, and that's the problem with so many of the leaders we have now, particularly the legacy leaders. They're happy just to be in the room, and you can't just be happy just to be in the room.
I heard.
But
that.
Also, this is an issue that really should transcend party, because here in Washington D.C., where I live, forget 9%. Forget 20%. In Ward 7 and 8, the black unemployment rate is over 40%.
Right.
And, you know, those of us who are black conservatives, some of us are on the front line fighting this issue. But when we criticize the president, it's not because we are anti-president. Sometimes we're criticizing him because he just deserves to be criticized. Mm-hmm. And so all of us need to take a step back sometimes and just say, look, let's just deal with the issue.
Yeah.
And let's talk about the policies that we can use to bring our community forward.
One of the things that you make clear in your book, which I think you have to confront, is one of the fundamental problems that we have is we want to deny the reality that race plays. And I'm going to come back to the Hollywood piece. Mm-hmm. We call it liberal Hollywood.
Right.
The issue that I have, I don't give a damn about somebody getting nomination. The issue I have is that if you got nominated for an Oscar, those movies were germinating for 3, 4, 5, 7, 8, 9 years. And those were directors, and those were writers, and those were producers, and those were the people who were grips. Spike Lee, when he did Malcolm X, he told the Teamsters, do y'all have any black truck drivers? They said, no. He said, well, the Fruit of Islam gonna drive my trucks unless y'all hire some black folks. All of a sudden, the next day, 5 black truck drivers were found. Mm-hmm. Spike was making an economic argument. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of this is about driving economic issue, telling whites, look, stop blocking us from these critical jobs.
Right. And I think this is what's so brilliant about what Reverend Barber is doing in North Carolina. Right. Reverend Barber is building a coalition
with
Moral Mondays and the Forward Together movement. He's building a coalition across ideological differences, a moral argument. He's hitting those who are locked out, who are on the margins, the most economically vulnerable. He's trying to push an agenda to challenge the extremism of the right. But he's doing so in a way where we're not beholden to some easy democratic agenda. Right.
And in fact, what ended up happening was when all of a sudden there were white conservatives in North Carolina who saw him fighting for rural hospitals. They went, whoa, that's my hospital. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden there were teachers and firefighters. Mm-hmm. And so he took the issue, and they all of a sudden woke up and went, wait a minute, he's talking to me. So that's why when you see these white working class voters who are showing up for Trump's rally, they should be saying, wait a minute.
Right.
Is he talking about those issues, or I'm simply responding to hype? Folks, the book is called Democracy in Black, How Race Still Enslaves the American Soul by Eddie Glaude. You definitely want to get that. Eddie, we appreciate it. Thanks so much.
Appreciate you.
Not a problem. Hold tight 1 second. We come back to have a smile. It talks about the final year of Dr. King's life. Folks, it was not easy going for Dr. King. Plus, how did the Bible play a role in Dr. King's last great speech? We'll have that as well. Plus, Sweet Honey in the Rock. We hear their wonderful voices right here on News One Now on TV One.
Oh, we shall not with us like a tree.
There may be some tear gas ahead.
Yeah.
I say to you this afternoon that I would rather die on the highways of Alabama than make a butchery of my conscience.
Yes, sir.
Kickstart your day at 7 and get the news you need from the perspective you want. News One Now with Roland Martin, every weekday morning at 7 on TV One.
Dr. King gave his Beyond Vietnam speech on April 4th, 1967 at the Riverside Church. He was killed April 4th, 1968. The last year of his life was a difficult one for him. Tavis Smiley talked about that in the book, Death of a King, the real story of Martin Luther King Jr.'s final year. Here's our conversation.
The most controversial talk of his life ever. And in that speech, he comes out, it's called Beyond Vietnam. He comes out in that speech and calls America the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today. That's a strong indictment, even from Dr. King, to call America, it's the black man in the 60s, telling America, you, America, are the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today. He goes on in that speech to talk about what he calls the triple threat of racism, poverty, and militarism. And for that speech, calling America out that way on the Vietnam War, the next day, everybody and everything turns on him. For the last year of his life, literally from April 4, 67 to April 4, 68, he has a target on his back every day of his life.
But what's interesting is that when you read Pernell Joseph's book on Stokely Carmichael Alive, it was really the young folks in SNCC who kept pushing Dr. King on Vietnam as well, because he wasn't that hard on it initially.
Yeah. He'd been out against the war, but you're right. He had not come out and given a major speech on it. But when he did, he paid a heavy price for it. And he loved Stokely. He loved the young students at SNCC. He loved Stokely. They had great debates about tactics, as you well know. Dr. King said, Black power is a wonderful slogan, but it's not a strategy.
Right.
And nonviolence had been the only strategy that had actually worked for black people. It worked in Montgomery with the bus boycott. It worked at the March on Washington. It worked to get the Voting Rights and Civil Rights Act passed. So Dr. King had a strategy that at least had worked, even though a lot of young folk in 67 and 68 thought he was sort of passe. They didn't want to hear about nonviolence. They wanted to hear about a more radical approach. But when King comes out against the war in Vietnam and gives this speech, the media turns on him, including the black media. When you read in this book with the New York Times, the Washington Post, Time Magazine, we ain't talking about Fox News. We're talking about the liberal media establishment came after him when he gave that speech. And then the White House turns on him, as you said. He and Johnson had worked together for voting and civil rights, but now Johnson is upset with him for contesting him on the Vietnam War question.
Again, I'm looking at public policy. Mm-hmm. If you look at what Dr. King was talking about, it all played out because what he was laying out is the resources that we were placing on Vietnam were dollars that, frankly, were not available to spend in the United States. Mm-hmm. If you come present day, the resources that we spent saving Wall Street when it came to TARP, when it came to bailing out the banks, were not about Main Street. We still see the tremendous housing crisis. We saw 53% of black wealth wiped out. Here we are also now with during airstrikes against Syria. And again, you're sort of operating in this same worldview. That is a time of war, and Dr. King's last year, spending resources. And then today, when people say, we don't have money to fund this, but it took them that long to find $500 million mm-hmm. to fund what's happening in Syria.
That's why if King were here, he'd still be talking about that triple threat, as he called it, the triple threat of racism, poverty, and militarism. As I said earlier, King said repeatedly that war is the enemy of the poor. And that was his critique of Johnson. So on the one hand, President Johnson says, Dr. King, you've called for a war on poverty, but now you engage in a war in Vietnam. Well, those two things are hard to juxtapose, because if you're serious about a war on poverty, you can't be squandering resources on a war in Vietnam. And so we see the same thing happening today, as you just, you know, astutely noted, that whenever they want to find money for something, they find it. But when it comes to eradicating poverty, poverty is threatening our very democracy now. It's a matter of national security, as far as I'm concerned. And if King were here right now, Lord help us, he'd have a critique in this moment of the military-industrial complex in this country that's on steroids, and people would still be throwing rocks at him right now. But he'd still be standing up, speaking his truth, and that's what's so beautiful about the story. King goes through all this hell and all this hate, starting April 4, 67, when he gives the speech, to the minute he takes that bullet to the head, April 4, 68. You know what the beautiful part of it is? Every day this Negro wakes up, he keeps telling the truth. When people don't want to hear it, he keeps telling it. When they don't believe him, he keeps telling it. When they don't like him, he keeps telling it. When they turn him off, he keeps telling it. Every day of his life, he keeps telling the truth. And all these years later, history has absolved him for being the truth teller that he was. So the point very quickly is that societies pay a price. I hope this is a cautionary tale from the book, that there's a huge price that we pay as a society when we ignore our truth tellers on the environment, on the use of drones, on poverty. We have to listen to our truth tellers, or we pay a heavy price for that long term.
Also, economically, he took a tremendous hit mm-hmm. as well. He was earning a lot of money when giving various speeches. That began to dry up. That impacts his family, impacts his kids. And he is under duress, if you will. So he is trying to establish this moral authority, mm-hmm. but all of a sudden people say, well, we like the moral authority on that other stuff, mm-hmm. but not when it comes to Vietnam.
They basically said to King, Negro, we've given you license to talk about civil rights. That's the lane you run in. You do not talk about foreign policy. Martin was saying that budgets are moral documents. Budgets are moral documents. You don't tell us how to set our spending priorities. Martin is saying that war is the enemy of the poor. The bombs you're dropping in Vietnam are landing in the ghettos and barrios of American cities. And they didn't really want to hear that critique. And so you're right. At the end of his life, he's bankrupt. As you know, Harry Belafonte has to pay for the funeral because Martin has no money. He's got death threats every single day. He feels that death angel hovering in his face. He knows there's a bullet out there with his name on it. We think the mountaintop speech the night before he died was when he all of a sudden realized that he may not get there with us. For the year leading up to that, he was getting death threats and knew every day that his life was in jeopardy. So he wants to organize this Poor People's Campaign here in Washington. He's going to be the original Occupy,
right,
not New York and Zuccotti Park. He's coming here to the National Mall with a tent city set up. And they just went after Dr. King. And again, it's a story that I want us to know, because if you really want to appreciate him, you got to see what we did to him in the last year of his life. In many ways, we helped to kill him because we abandoned Dr. King.
Wherever you are, we are your centerpiece for Black thoughts in America. It's News One Now with your host, Roland Martin.
Many of you have heard the last part of Dr. King's final speech, I've Been to the Mountaintop, but most folks don't understand that it is a 46-minute speech that is phenomenal. We spoke with Keith Miller, author of Martin Luther King's biblical epic, his final great speech, about it and how important it was.
I call his speech a famous speech, but also an unknown speech. It's famous because the last 2 minutes are famous, especially when he talks about going up to the top of the mountain and looking out to see the promised land, but I may not get there with you. But we as a people will get to the promised land. That part is famous, and people think that he's predicting his assassination the next day. But the rest of the speech is overlooked. But in order to understand the conclusion, you need to understand the entire speech. Because if he only wanted to speak for 2 minutes, he would have spoken for 2 minutes. So he spoke for 46 minutes. The conclusion concludes something. So in order to understand the conclusion, you have to understand the whole speech.
Well, it's the same thing I say every year when it comes to I Have a Dream speech. That was never even in the original written version. And again, as we focus on that, as opposed to looking at the entire thing, always from a black church standpoint, I say we focus on the hoop part. That's the hoop part. But you better understand the thesis and the scripture earlier in the speech. Earlier in the speech. So one thing that you lay out, the architecture of the church played a role in this? What do you mean by that?
I think the architecture of the church is very important, and it's been misrepresented by historians. They call it, quote, cavernous. It's not cavernous at all. It's an architectural jewel, and it's beautifully and brilliantly designed. Mason Temple in Memphis. It seats 3,734 people. I know because I counted the seats. So, but somehow the architect was so brilliant that he could get these seats close to the pulpit. So if there hadn't been 3,000 people able to come to the speech, King would not have given a speech at all, because this was the largest venue in the entire South that African Americans controlled. And King was exhausted. He was in his motel room that night. He didn't want to give the speech. And he gave the speech because Ralph Abernathy told him, there's 3,000 people here. We need to, you need to come down here, Martin. If he had been anywhere else, there wouldn't have been that many people there, because there was a giant thunderstorm that night that kept a lot of people away.
You say that King made it clear that the oppressed must focus on the Bible and, as you say, lift themselves above the persistent exploitation that they doggedly endure.
Yes, the speech offers King's interpretation of the Bible, and it's very important to understand that. He does something of a tour of the Bible in the speech. He starts out with the Exodus. He quotes Jeremiah. He quotes Isaiah. He quotes Amos. He has a long passage in the speech where he's talking about the parable of the Good Samaritan. And his professors in seminary taught him that the Bible was an ancient document. It's ancient history. It's ancient literature. You need to be an expert on the ancient past in order to understand it. And his Old Testament professor was an archaeologist. But King says, no, anybody can understand the Bible, because we are living in the Bible. And what's going on in Memphis is a new chapter in the Exodus. The Exodus is a story that keeps going on. For him, the Bible is only incidentally a book. The Bible is an ongoing narrative. The Exodus is still going on. The Civil Rights Movement is a new chapter in the Exodus, and he has a similar interpretation of the parable of the Good Samaritan.
Keith, what do you think? What do you make of the part of the speech where he says, if God were to ask him what time period would he like to live in, he would pick the second half of the 20th century? Why do you think he would pick that?
That's important, because before King got to Memphis, the national press was paying zero attention to Memphis and the garbage workers' strike. The garbage workers are all
ignoring him, too.
Sure. And they were ignoring him, too. Right. They were trying to write him off. So when he gets there, he takes this Memphis strike, which the press is ignoring, and he's saying, he's lining it up with these great events in history. I want to go back in time. I want to go back to the Exodus. I want to go back to the Emancipation Proclamation. And he's lining up the strike in Memphis with these great events in history. He's saying, this is so important, as opposed to the news media not even paying attention to Memphis. So he's redesigning the strike.
And this has got to be, you know, one of the speeches that I probably paid most attention to over the course of my career. I saw it as a roadmap. I saw it as, King's way of lining out what justice really looked like. He says in this speech, you know, let the issues remain where they are. The issue is justice. And he lines out that it is economic freedom, that it is political freedom, that it is a whole host of things. And so I guess I ask you, if you were talking to the young people of Ferguson today, if you were talking to the young people who fill the streets in New York or D.C., what salient point do you think they ought to take from this particular writing?
King focuses on justice, and that's the reason to focus on the Exodus, because the Exodus is a story of escaping from oppression and escaping from slavery. What King is, to me, what he's saying about the present is, you are important, your issue is important, oppression can still be going on, we may need another Exodus, and you may live in some tiny town, you may live in a small neighborhood in a giant city, you may think that you're not important, but these ordinary people, these strikers in Memphis, who Most of them dropped out of high school. They were important players in an important drama. So he's saying that people who think they might be ordinary are capable of extraordinary deeds. And that's what fueled the civil rights movement, the masses of people who look like ordinary people who are making extraordinary sacrifices and creating extraordinary accomplishments.
The book is an amazing book. It is Martin Luther King's biblical epic, His Final Great Speech by Keith D. Miller. Folks, certainly read the book, but definitely you want to hear the speech. I'm glad you broke it down, Keith, because a lot of people, literally, only hear that last part. But they totally ignore the other 45 minutes, if you will.
Right.
And it is an absolutely phenomenal speech there. We appreciate it. Thanks a bunch.
Thank you, sir.
The first step is to join the movement.
Begin to mobilize and move people to action now.
Step number two, roll out.
The way I roll is when you've shown one time you can do it, no excuses after that.
We're your centerpiece for Black thoughts in America. It's News One Now. With Roland Martin. Roland Martin.
It's MLK Day, folks. There'll be lots of events, lots of programs. But don't forget, music played a huge part in the civil rights movement. The Freedom Singers, the Freedom Songs, Sweet Honey and the Rock, they were one of those groups nominated, of course, for a Grammy, this great a cappella group. Well, we talked to them on Friday. We're going to have their interview later this week right here on News One Now. So we want to leave you, though, with their amazing voices. This is them singing Ella Song. So you guys have a great King Day. We'll end you with Sweet Honey in the Rock.
Oh, we shall not quit just like a tree, just like a tree planted by the water. We shall not be fighting for our freedom.
Wherever you are, we are your centerpiece for Black thoughts in America. It's News One Now with your host, Roland Martin.